Stanley L. Cavell has written on existentialism, on ethics, on the relationship between philosophy and the arts. He received his doctorate from Harvard in 1961. He was born in Atlanta, Georgia. He has spent a good bit of time at the University of California at Berkeley. He is the Walter M. Cabot Professor of Aesthetics in the General Theory of Value, and he teaches HUM 5 in the Gen Ed course, and he is our moderator tonight.
In this very room, I teach HUM 5, or taught. 4 or 5 years ago, faced with the beginning of a new term, and with the commitment to give yet another course or seminar in the philosophy of art, my spirits drooped, remembering a long chain of secondhand literary opinions, of incompetent analysis of pieces of music, and of heavings with old German giants in the history of painting and architecture. And I wondered if something else couldn't happen for the next 4 months. My spirits raised, thinking that perhaps that term we would use the film as the art with which we would be concerned throughout our speaking about the philosophy of the arts. Why not? The film is the art that all the members of the generation that I was going to be teaching had in common, and it was the one art that I shared with them. Over coffee, a conversation could naturally arise about the nature of Bogart's grip on the imagination of certain members of our society, or about whether Truffaut really knew what he was doing in Jules and Jim, or whether he accepted his characters' views of themselves. In such conversations in an academic setting, there were the usual tests. Also, for example, do you know who the two cops are in The Maltese Falcon? But the point of those conversations is that they were natural and they were passionate. And I thought, why not use that in a course about aesthetics? Natural and passionate in the way in which a conversation about a novel or a poem were likely to be studied or dutiful. We could also, I thought, turn some of the obvious defects in speaking about film into virtues. The fact, for example, that there is not a large canon of writing about the film to rely on. So we'll make it up ourselves, out of this experience, which presumably is undeniable. Well, it didn't work out too well. Some of the questions were, I still think, engrossing ones. Questions having to do with not just what a popular art is, but questions having to do with the audience of an art, and in particular, what it takes that a given object appeal to all classes of society at a given moment. There are very few great artists who have been able to manage that, but a few of the very greatest, and do, and some of the very greatest do not. Films, good and bad, seem to be able to do that. That's one of their attractions. We discovered a number of things in talking about films, like, for example, that they were extremely difficult to remember accurately. And we tried to make some philosophy out of that fact, asking ourselves, as philosophers do, what's it like to remember a film? And is that like remembering a novel or the exact shades of color in a picture? And so on. We came to grief very often Not so much over a question of what the evidence for our remarks was, but the fact that we couldn't use ourselves, as at the beginning I had hoped we'd be able to do, as our own source of evidence. We lacked, I felt, authority. Nobody quite knew why things were happening in a film as they were happening and in the order in which they were happening. Tonight's panel was exactly what we needed. These three people can be asked anything, and they all hope, and I hope you will ask them anything. There could not be three people whose credits and competences were more complete. And moreover, the three people who cover the range of one's interest in film now, in what it's like to criticize it, in how the traditional glamorous products are made, and what's happening now when the glamour is beyond the reach and the pocketbook of too many people who want to make them. Our first speaker will be Joshua Logan, who seems to have never done anything wrong. When he went to college, it was to Princeton in the 20s. And he managed to go with James Stewart and Henry Fonda, and they had Margaret Sullivan along. Those people, not everybody in this room is of the right age to have those three figures as images from one's youth. But unless you've seen Love Story with Jimmy Stewart and Margaret Sullivan in it, and they probably both die. She certainly dies in the end, but so beautifully and very womanly, and you care very much about why she's dying. And he's awkward. And Henry Fonda's very beautiful in some of the early films in which he was not a great star yet. When he dropped out of college, it came time to do that. It was to go to Moscow and study with Stanislavski. When he had to fight a war, he picked the last war in which practically everybody in this country thought it was a good war to be fighting. When he directs on Broadway, he has the genius to cast Ezio Pinza and Mary Martin together. When he directs his latest film, he sees to it that Lerner and Lowe have written the tune and that Vanessa Redgrave is going to be doing his bidding. These are intelligent moves. I learned something also from this dazzling biography of Mr. Logan's. Something that hadn't been quite clear to me before, partly his having studied with Stanislavski and his profound interest in the legitimate theater explains this. Also his having been born in Texarkana, Texas, explains another piece of it, and that's why, for me, Marlon Brando's performance in Sayonara was so extraordinary. I still think it to be the best image of a southern, certain kind of southerner that I've ever seen. Mr. Logan knows what such southerners are like, I find, and also has the gifts to elicit a performance of that magnitude from somebody that, if they've only been to the movies, one might not know is one of the great living actors. I don't know when it was that I first realized that Hollywood movies are actually made by people. I don't know what I thought they used to be. They happened, or they came out of some building, or maybe the man on the corner who owned the movie theater produced them. But at some point, and it's fairly recent, I did discover that they were, and one of the people, one of the great figures in the making of them, has been Mr. Joshua Logan, who will speak to us now. distinguished professor, interlocutor, did not point out one of the more important right things that I did. And I think that is the very fundamental one of being born on the right side of Texarkana. Texarkana is divided in the middle by State Line Avenue, and one side is Arkansas, and the other is Texas. And I would like to have you know that I was born on the paved side of the street. It was many years later that they paved the Arkansas side. I never went back to see it. We're to talk tonight about coming of age of the motion picture. And I was going to say that almost everything in our country seems to be, or in other countries too, as far as that goes, seems to be a kind of cycle. Because it seems to me that we are back to where movies were when I was 6 years old. And there was a kind of freedom that we finally have got back to. This is a time when, for the first time in our memory practically, certainly in your memory, there was a freedom of expression. There is a freedom of expression because of a relaxing of that terrible thing, the code, censorship. And we're going to get onto that subject later, but I just thought that I would tell you that, you know, today the Italian movies show rather lurid love scenes. I don't think they're lurid. I think they're lovely, but other people call them lurid. We are allowed to see the various strange people that exist in our world and that have twisted lives, and we're able to use the word, for instance, for the first time, homosexuality, or we can even say the word syphilis, you know, which was never allowed before. We can even show certain things that are in a home that only appear in bathrooms. You know, up to this time, there's been such a stringent code that people could not tell stories with any kind of freedom or adultness, because they couldn't mention certain things. But I remember back in Mansfield, Louisiana, where I moved quickly to get away from Texarkana. I must tell you, it was not a very elaborate choice, but it was a little bit perhaps better. This little town had one movie theater, a tiny movie theater. The theater was smaller than the screen. And since it was, since you were either a Methodist or a Baptist, it didn't matter whether you were Jewish or Catholic, you had to be Methodist or Baptist. That's all there is to it. Or people didn't understand, they didn't know how to put you in the right category. I was a Methodist, and it was a sin to do everything as a Methodist in those days. It was a sin to, well, certainly a sin to drink or smoke, but it was also a sin to dance. And you can imagine what kind of a sin it was to go to the movies. But D.W. Griffith did a picture, thank goodness, because otherwise I don't think I would have ever, I'd be up even here if he hadn't. He made a picture called Judith of Bethulia. And Judith of Bethulia is the story of Judith and Holofernes. And it is a part of the Apocrypha of the Bible. Now, my mother, who taught Sunday school at the Methodist Church, thought that her Bible reading was rather fuzzy, because she didn't really know exactly what Judith of Bethulia was about. And she felt, but it must be, if it's from the Bible, it must be all right for my children to see. So my sister and I were taken to see this biblical story that was going to make us have purer and more beautiful minds. And my sister was very small, and I was pretty small. I think I was about 6 or 7. And we went to see this movie. Very excited, too. And this was the time when our films were a little like Italian films are today.
there was a great deal of nudity. Judith, for instance, who was going to seduce Holofernes and get him in her tent and then pour some wine and put a little biblical Nembutal or something inside of it, or LSD or something, and absolutely knock out Holofernes. Then she was going to pull out, which my mother didn't know, a scimitar and cut off his head. Well, my sister and I were sitting there looking at all this nudity. Suddenly we saw that she had things on and that we were never allowed to discuss. When her slip would fall off her shoulder or something, we would see things that we weren't allowed to talk about. And we began to think, is this what the movie's like? Is this what the Bible's like? We were really very excited. Now, we got to the climactic moment. My mother had begun to be a bit worried. But since she brought us here, she said, well, I might as well find out how it turns out. And we got to the place where Judith poured the stuff in, and he took it and drank, and he began to nod, his head began to go, and out came the scimitar, and her breasts now were almost bare. And she lifted it above his head and was just ready to whack down on his neck when my mother grabbed our heads and shoved them down behind the seats. And she said, duck your heads and think of fields of yellow daisies. Now, I hesitated to tell that story in front of Miss Judith Crist because I'm terribly afraid that it will give her something to say. I'm so terribly afraid that when she reviews Camelot, she's going to say, he's still doing it. I am not going to go on much further because we have a very interesting group of people to listen to tonight, and I want to hear them just as much as you do. I would just like to say one thing, and it's very short. It's this. I hope you're interested not only in law, but in what I consider the most powerful force in the world, which is the performing arts, in my estimation. I think our country is finally growing up. For many, many years, we were afraid of art. We thought it was something soft. We looked askance at our boys if they said they were going to be violinists or dancers or artists or watercolorists or photographers. We would allow our girls to play the harp, maybe, or something like that, but that's about all. We're pioneer people. We're for the almighty dollar. But suddenly we're beginning to realize, I think we're beginning to realize, I hope we're beginning to realize, that art is the personality of our country. It is through art that we show ourselves as human beings and our foibles and our goodnesses and badnesses and strangenesses are in our art. We can therefore reach across borders, across oceans, and show ourselves to other people through our art, particularly our performing arts, the plays, the operas, the ballets, the movies, and someday even maybe the television. But we can show and influence and gain friends and gain peace, perhaps, by exchanging the most powerful thing there is, art. It's not bombs, it's not money, it's not people talking about how powerful our country is, or it's not lending money to other countries or buying people's friendship. It is developing that thing that makes life worth living. It is developing that thing that makes you feel so much better if you've turned enough pages and get to the book review or the movie review or the play review, and you learn that there's something besides what's happening on those first four or five pages. It is art. And I hope that this evening will help us learn and help some of you to maybe develop for us some playwrights, some scenarists, mostly the writers of our theater. We need them. I understand that there's a great deal of, that there are many girls and boys in this area. If you can't write plays yourself, make us some playwrights.
One of the saddest things about the passing of the Herald Tribune and of its not perfectly legitimate offspring was the passing of that handsome new or newly designed magazine, New York. And in particular, if your experience was mine, of the chance of reading in it every week the thoughts of Judith Crist on the recent movies that she'd seen in New York. She is, as the critic in All About Eve almost said, an oasis in the desert of American literary journalism. It's all but unique to find someone writing regularly for a newspaper about one of the arts who writes with seriousness and literacy and out of genuine information. Unless you read the TV guide these days to find out more than what's on the late movies, or unless you get up early enough in the morning or stay up late enough to see the Today Show, it's not likely that you follow Mrs. Crist's writings regularly any longer. It's all a greater pleasure, therefore, to have her here tonight. Mrs. Crist.
Thank you. I think I should point out from the outset that I grew up with a picture over my mother's night table of a dark-haired, almost totally clothed heroine clutching an enormous sword and holding a man's head in the other hand. And it said, Judith avec la tête d'Holofernes. So I was otherwise oriented in my childhood. But I must tell you something about the Methodists, who, I must say, have been changing since Mr. Logan's youth. This summer, I was at Lake Winnipesaukee at Geneva Point at the Boston Area Pastors Assembly of the Methodist Church, and I was up there to show them some movies and talk about movies during this three-day meeting. And out of the 150 Methodist ministers who were there, I would say that 85% of them had seen Blow Up, and 95% of them wanted to talk about Blow Up, which gave me the feeling that Methodism, among other parts of life, has done a little changing. I grew up in the post-Griffith movie era, movies talked. I think the first movie I had ever seen was The Gold Rush, but then there was a great lapse. I had a deprived childhood and did not see very many movies until the middle 30s, when, of course, talkies were in flower. And the things that I remember most vividly were, as far as the maturity of movies were concerned, that, again, I had a very peculiar feeling about my own home. Because in a movie, I never saw people who were married, not just in bed together, but I never saw them owning a double bed. Because under the production code of Hollywood, and it was a great thing for the furniture industry, all of America slept in twin beds. That is married America, in the same room. Not only that, but naturally, everyone went to bed clothed right up to here. In not only pajamas for the men, both pieces, please, but the women not only were swathed in layer upon layer of frou-frou, but they also went to bed with ribbons in their hair, and they woke up with those same ribbons sitting on top of those immaculate waves. You also grew up, of course, with the notion that American family life was largely on the Andy Hardy style, or so I felt. You had to have that spinster aunt around. You had to have the good gray father who was always right. And the problems in life consisted of overspending your allowance and inviting the two girls for one date and so on. And what I would tend, in thinking back to the movies that marked my youth, to say, they were pretty immature. And now we're finally getting to be kind of adult about movies because we can see all varieties of sex and 29 varieties of psychosis and all the bloodshed that we possibly can. And boy, this is pretty adult, and I am glad to be over 18 so that I can see it. I then think back again to the movies that were made over those years, and some of the very greatest and most mature of American and European movies were made in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. And I am startled to think that movies are suddenly growing up. They aren't. I think movies today are once again, as they were briefly, I suppose, in the 20s, and as they have been in Europe, are to be shown, that we are able to see things. Mr. Logan and Miss Clark have both made movies that technically could have been made a very long time ago. But I do not think that you could see Miss Clark's current film, which is Portrait of Jason. I don't know whether you would have been able to see it 5 years ago, let alone 10 or 20 years ago. Would this movie have been made? I don't know. Shirley Clarke was 20 years younger. I don't know if the subject would have come into the path of a movie maker at that time. But I certainly know that it would not have been shown. Well, what about the so-called new freedom? What I think is changing is the audience. I think we are becoming a far more critical audience as far as movies go. I didn't know that movies weren't for real until I was about 11, and I was very bright, if I must point to my past. But I thought that when somebody got thrown off a cliff, particularly if he was a zombie or a walking dead or a ghoul, that when he got thrown off a cliff, he was really dead. And I did not know that they threw dummies over cliffs when I was 11 years old when they made movies. Movies were terribly real to me. Today, children of 8 and 9 are highly sophisticated about how movies are made. Movies have lost the magic in that respect. We're very wise technically. We live with movies, many of us, and not necessarily of us, but so many in the population live with movies going on in their house almost 18 hours a day. The television set is thunked on. It's not watched for 18 hours, but it sure runs all day long. And 90% of what is going on that screen is film of various kinds. It is a part of our lives. We grow up with it. And a generation that has been weaned with television, let alone probably nursed to its accompaniment, naturally is a thoroughly audio-visual-oriented generation. And I think it has almost automatically become a more critical generation. And I think that it is the audience that is changing, and not the films. But my one hope for film is that with the changing audience, the movies eventually will catch up with their public. And I think that it is only through the audience that we will succeed in making movies grow up. This very notion that you can see naked people and what do we want to call it, abnormalities and certain brands of violence only if you're over 18, is a ludicrous one. The content of a film is adult only, for me, in a purely intellectual sense. And this is where the audience can be the only judge of whether a movie is grown up. I don't think movies grow up. I think the people who make them, but even more important, the people who watch them are the ones who have to do the growing up. Thank you.
An American movie is no longer a phrase synonymous with a Hollywood movie. And one of the reasons for this is that movies are being made by individuals outside studios, and not just are being made, but stunning, excellent movies are being made in such a way. One of the most important figures in the development of the non-studio movie in this country is Miss Shirley Clark, whose films have already been mentioned by both speakers. And I won't take any more time, but let her tell us something about them. Miss Clark.
I'm much better at answering questions than talking to you, but there are a couple of things that occurred to me in listening to Mr. Logan and Mrs. Crist that perhaps are relevant in this whole area of who's growing up, where, and how. Perhaps, I guess, what I most represent is what we would like to call personal filmmaking. And this is a very, very loose word that I prefer to the word underground or to the word experimental or to the word avant-garde, which are also words that are thrown around in this connection. Nevertheless, it is true that since the Second World War in the United States, a very large movement has grown up, mostly around New York City and San Francisco, of what might be called personal filmmakers. Now, part of this was due to the phenomenon of the availability of 16-millimeter equipment. After the Second World War, there was surplus cameras and surplus film, and the experimental filmmakers of the 40s were people who picked up cameras very much the way home movies people use cameras. They just used them with a little different intent. Not everybody would agree. Some people perhaps would even call what we're doing today home movies. And if so, that's not necessarily bad. I tend to think that the young people today who would 20 years ago have been poets are the kind of people that will pick up a camera themselves and go out. Now, I began making films in the 50s. And at the time, in about 1956 or 7, we had an organization known as Independent Filmmakers of America, a very brave name, which included 30 filmmakers in New York City that covered the area of documentary filmmaking and experimental filmmaking. Today in New York City, in the Filmmakers Co-op, which is the, this other organization disappeared within about 3 years after we all sat and watched each other's films and criticized them. But meanwhile, in the 60s, under, I guess probably through the work of, mostly of Jonas Mekas, the Filmmakers Co-op came into existence, and it now has a membership of over 300 filmmakers. To be a member of the co-op merely means that you have put a film into the co-op and it is distributed by them through a catalog that is sent basically to the universities throughout the country. Now, not only has this movement grown in New York, it is quite large in San Francisco. Boston has a co-op. There is a co-op in Colorado. Los Angeles has the start of a co-op. There's the beginning of such a group in Washington, D.C., and probably many others that are on the verge now of forming themselves. This is a movement that could only have taken place in the United States of America and could only have taken place because of Hollywood. In the other countries, a young filmmaker, either, let's say, if he came from one of the eastern countries like Poland, Russia, Czechoslovakia, would have gone to a film school and upon graduation have gone into the film industry that is totally government supervised and subsidized. In the case of countries, let's say, like France and England, you get a situation where a young person wanting to make a film submits a script, and very often half the money is given by the government and the other half is raised to match funds. And this allows for a kind of subsidy for filmmaking. But in the United States, the choice was, if you were not the kind of person that was going to fit into the Hollywood studio system of filmmaking, you either made industrial movies or perhaps documentary movies, and just in the last 10 years has this, what started as really quite a small movement in the 40s, grown to the major proportions that it has today. Now, this encompasses many more areas than I think you are led to believe by the national press. Unfortunately, usually it's only things that are in some way exciting or whatever that get press attention, and therefore when you read about the underground quote cinema, you read and would expect to see what you hope, I suppose, to be pornographic, artistically made pornographic films. If you go for that reason, you're going to be mighty disappointed. First of all, there are very few of them. But secondly, most of the people who are working in this area follow a very broad spectrum, from making a film like Troublemakers, which is a film on the situation in Newark the year before the riots took place, to a film like Chelsea Girls by Warhol, to let's say a film that I've made called Bridges Go Round, which is merely a 3-minute film about the bridges of Manhattan, to dance films, to enormous variety of film. The one thing that they have in common is they're basically paid for somehow or other by the person making the film. Very often it may be that you have a situation of a limited partnership, which, for instance, is, let's say, how a film like The Cool World was made, where a producer raises money from many different individuals, and it's a system quite similar to what is used for the Broadway theater. In other cases, somebody's aunt maybe let you have the money. What we now have established in the terms of the co-op and the distribution center is the hope that by distributing our films ourselves, eventually the filmmakers will make enough money from their films to continue making films. I give you this background because I have a feeling that there is a great deal of misinformation on what is the underground cinema. And when we talk a little further, perhaps we can go into more details of where the differences lie and what the problems are of making studio-made films or so-called personal filmmaking. Thank you.
What we'd like now is to have any of you join the discussion who'd like to. We have to ask you to come down and say your name into this microphone here. Don't be intimidated by that.
Oh, boy.
And ask any of the speakers anything you'd like, either about something they've said or something you'd like to hear an authoritative answer to. Anyway, I know that each of the speakers tonight would rather talk than give a speech. So this is the time that they have most been waiting for. Perhaps while you're gathering your own thoughts, we might ask the panelists themselves their questions they want to address to one another. Or if that's unfair.
Yes. Well, no, that's not unfair. I think that's a good idea. I think it takes time to have everyone realize that we really do want you to be part of this evening. It's what will make it a decent evening. Just three people talking to you means nothing compared to firing a few ideas back and forth, even stimulating an argument, if possible. And don't feel that you have to be nice or pussyfoot. Just come right out with it and ask the most direct and embarrassing possible questions. Yes. Well, if he yelled it, we could probably repeat it, if you
want.
Oh, I see.
Terminally comes up.
My name is David Gernandt, a third-year law student. I'd like to ask each of the three panelists and the moderator whether he thinks the critic or the filmmaker is going to have... Each of the three panelists and the moderator, whether he thinks the critic or the filmmaker is going to have or does have the greater influence in the profession or the art of filmmaking. In this connection, I'd like to ask you to speculate on the relative inherent creativity exhibited by critics and filmmakers, and ask, for instance, whether Bosley Crowther and Judith Chris are less creative people than people like Shirley Clarke and Joshua Logan, because the critics only critic and the filmmakers seem to have a more direct artistic relationship with what they're doing.
Would you like to repeat the question?
No. You're very wise to have it said down there. Did all of you hear it, by the way? Did you hear the question? Miss Christ.
Well, I can see why you're a third-year law student. That was loaded. You know, when the paper went out of existence in the spring, I was very pleased when a movie maker, whom I happen to respect and whose movies I have
thoroughly panned, asked me to come make movies with him. You know, write, edit, do this, do that, advise me, I'll pick your brain and so forth, and there will be the kidney-shaped swimming pool in Beverly Hills. And the temptation was mighty, you know. I thought, oh my, suddenly life can reverse itself, and what exciting things could come from it. And I brooded on it, and then I realized that, well, you know the old saw about those who can do and those who cannot teach. I then extended it to say that those who like to think that they could if they would, but are smart enough not to, criticize.
That's an answer. That's a wonderful answer.
I have a different reaction to this question, which is I think it's just very different kinds of people are interested in different kinds of things. I find myself very unable to criticize most people's films, including my own. The only way I deal with my own films are things I like and don't like about them, things that I say I'm trying to do and whether I have or haven't succeeded in doing it. And I just don't think that way. And I think that being a critic is being a different kind of person. It isn't a matter of one person being more creative than another. You're just different in your interests. For me as a filmmaker, the thing I find the saddest is that there are very few critics that are really critics. Very rarely have I read reviews of films of mine that have helped me particularly to understand something about them that perhaps I wouldn't. If they have been liked, usually the level that they're liked on is perhaps not the one I was even thinking about. And very often, if they're disliked, it's for something that I also wasn't concerned with. But basically, I just don't think we're the same order of beast.
I think I could say that I agree somewhat with both of these ladies in what they say, but I feel that there's still one further point. I have spent a lot of my years in this town, Boston, and quite a number of the most painful minutes or hours of those years were spent reading the Boston critics. You know, I'm from the theater, and I've done most of my work in the theater. And when we do plays in the theater, we have 3.5 weeks or 4 weeks rehearsal, and then suddenly we're in front of an audience. And generally, the first audience is the Boston audience, or a New Haven audience has seen maybe a first tryout, and the Boston audience sees a slightly smoother show, but still a show that is not quite baked. It is not quite a brown loaf that you can take out of an oven. It's a sort of a white doughy thing that hasn't been there long enough. And I have developed a healthy respect for critics. I must say that when you make a movie, such as my last one, and there's very little left to do about it, it's very painful to read them because you say, oh, yes, of course, that idea didn't come across. Oh, if I could only redo it. But you can't take a big, hefty thing like a 3-hour film and go back and put it through the cutting department and all of the dubbing and looping and all that has to be done in order to make one slight change. But on the stage, when we come here to Boston, or to New Haven, or to Philadelphia, before we've come to New York, we learn to listen and read carefully the critics. And the critics at that point become creators, as far as I'm concerned, because they tell us what the audience is thinking, what came across, what didn't come across. It's not the fact that they point it out carefully and say this idea didn't come across. It's what they say about the film, about the play. What they say, what offends them. It isn't because it necessarily is offensive. It's because it hasn't been properly put across. It hasn't been properly interpreted. If I find a criticism of a performance, it is generally because the actor hasn't quite got his performance under control. I have spent many an hour talking to particularly Mr. Elliot Norton and saying, what did you mean by that line? Please tell me. I would like to know why this play is not getting over. And quickly, I would just like to tell you an example of what happened to me on a play called Picnic. I was touring the country with Picnic. We opened in Columbus, Ohio. It got terrible notices. It was so bad that there was no point in even asking, because it just was a complete fiasco. And then we went to St. Louis, Missouri, and they just said it was such a terrible play that there was no way of explaining how awful it was. And for heaven's sake, don't anybody go see it, because it's so dreadful. So then I don't know why we kept on going, because it was rather silly, it seemed to me. There were only about 25 people in the audience, the poor actors, and among them were Paul Newman and Ralph Meeker and Janice Rule and Eileen Heckert and Arthur O'Connell and Kim Stanley. Marvelous cast, but pitifully going ahead with these terrible reviews and this completely befuddled sort of audience that wasn't even really there, just only half there. We got to Cleveland, same notices, same thing, terrible, dreadful. And I read the notices, and I couldn't find out anything. I couldn't even ask any of the critics what was wrong, because they didn't like anything. And finally, I learned by hearing some people talking in the audience. You generally don't hear anything when you hear people talking in the audience, you know. Howard Lindsay tells the story of Dorothy Stickney. His wife was out in the lobby in between acts trying to hear what the audience was saying. And she listened very carefully to two women talking quietly, and all she heard was this line: "The author's wife is behind you, all ears." But sometimes, and once in my life, I got something from the audience. As I passed, some men passed me in the audience, I heard them say, "Some hero." And for some reason, that meant something to me. It meant that they thought that this man who was playing the protagonist of our play, of our picture, was a hero. And that we were trying to put across to the audience the idea that this man was a fine Lochinvar come out of the West on a clean white horse, instead of this terrible bum who was very strange and unsure of himself and was always making the wrong remarks. And it was through that remark, and then asking some friends of mine who saw it, who said, "Well, I just can't stand that man who plays the lead. He just swaggers and brags all over the place." Well, by hearing that, I went to Bill Inge and I said, for some reason, the audience feels that we like this man and think he's perfect the way he is, instead of that he's a poor slob of a fellow who might turn out to be a little bit better, but probably might not. So Bill put some lines in the play which explained to the audience where they stood and where we stood. The mother said to Paul Newman, the rich boy, whom everybody liked because he was rich and because he was good-looking, and he was clean, and all the women approved of the fact that the girl might marry him. We said to the mother, we had the mother say, rather Bill did, but this boy, what's he like? And she said, "Well, no, he's really a nice fellow, Mrs. Whatever her name is. I roomed with him in college, and he seems, at first I couldn't stand the way he bragged and swaggered all over the place, but after a while, I got to know him, and some of the things he brags about are the truth. What do the other boys think of him?" she said. "They used to bristle when he came into the room. They couldn't stand him." Well, the moment those lines were in the story, Picnic became a hit. The audience knew that we didn't think he was perfect. But up until that time, for some reason, well, if it weren't, they were not critics, but they were kind of amateur critics. And it is that kind of thing that can help us. And I think critics have been helpful to me all my life. I only wish that now that I have made a couple of big movies, I could go back after having seen it and spend 2 more months and take advantage of some of the things that have been said. But unfortunately, in the case of certain films, the die is cast. I don't know what that means.
You get to ask a question. Yes, first, thank you. I want to. Yes.
My name is Howard Reiter. I was wondering about the fact that so far the expression films growing up seems to pertain here just to sex and nudity. I was wondering, though, about the question of race, particularly the criticism that has been made that when a Negro actor is given a role, particularly a leading role in a film, he usually is not presented as a real person. If he's the protagonist, as Sidney Poitier often is, he often plays a sort of godlike figure, really. Not anyone of any depth, and not anyone certainly who can err, who has faults. And I was wondering if the panel can comment on this.
You're quite right. I think that when we talk about the Hollywood movie, certainly there has been a terrible dichotomy in its attitudes toward Negro actors. That's very old hat. Whether it is changing, I don't know. You almost get the feeling at times that Hollywood thinks now that it's very stylish to have movies involving Negroes, and you wind up, of course, with complete heroism. I think that one will have to look in large part to the independent filmmaker for any honesty in coping with the question. I don't know if you saw a film that was an independent one called Nothing But a Man, that I think, and I have found most Negroes I know feel, was the one film that dealt honestly with the Negro, was because basically he was, the movie was about him as a man whose problems were intensified by the fact that he lived in a depressed southern area and whose problems were quintuply intensified by the fact that he was a Negro in the South. And there was a film that coped with it. I keep looking for straws in the wind. I mean, the other night I was looking at The Defiant Ones again on television. And there I thought there was a far more human approach to Sidney Poitier than one's recollection lets one believe. In The Heat of the Night, I felt, well, now we're progressing because Poitier is not all saint. He is a man with a great big streak of bigotry in himself. He is allowed a certain, at least a bad temper, let's say, and a bit of prejudice. But this is the whole problem one faces in mass media, you know, of how you are going to treat matters of race. There was some discussion yesterday about why aren't there more Negroes in television. So what has ended up this season is that every detective has a Negro assistant. You know, you think suddenly the Negro in America is doing absolutely nothing but being a sergeant assisting people, who still, it's the white man who is solving the crimes. The whole cast of society. And this, of course, is the entire problem of our society that is expressed in the arts. At the same time, I think it abhorrent that they're taking the whole cast of Dolly and suddenly turning it into an all-Negro production, which to me is quite reprehensible. This is going from one extreme to an equal extreme of bigotry. But I wish there was something more mature about it. The hero of Portrait of Jason, the hero, the one man, the sole actor, Jason, happens to be a Negro. And it is part of, indeed, an integral part of the portrait. And I don't think that this is any saintly portrait, but it's a fascinating human portrait. This you can do, perhaps, in an independent personal film, but most movies are made with an eye to commerce. And who would approve if your villain turned out to be a Negro? It's the same thing as in newspapers, you know. If you were a polite newspaper, you never identified anyone as a Negro, unless he won a prize. and the not nice papers identified him as a Negro only if he had committed a crime.
You know, I think it's not just the movies growing up. I think it's a question of America and of the Negroes themselves. You know, it seems to me that we're the victim of what has been known recently as a thing called gentleman's agreement. I must say I'm beginning to long for the dear old days of violent race prejudice. I really think that it was at least healthier than where we are at this particular moment, in which we don't dare say anything, whether we're Negro or white. We can't say anything about the Negroes without offending them, or they can't say anything about us without seeming to lose their godlike image. They're taking Huck Finn out of the libraries now because the word N-I-G-G-E-R is used in there for nigger Jim is not allowed to be said, even though it was written by Mark Twain. You can't sing a Stephen Foster song. The whole background of the Negro race is now suddenly become a sort of colored with some vague blankness, so that it's going to sound like that nothing ever happened, that they never were a poor begotten race that came here because they were the victims of slavery. Maybe this new book will teach us something a little bit different. But right now, I think we're in a very childish period in the handling of the subject of the Negro. I think we're absolutely so scared that we're making gods of every Negro hero, as Mrs. Chris said. The man was allowed to lose his temper a couple of times, but he was the cleanest, finest man that ever walked, and every white man around him was despicable. It seems to me it would have been a much richer picture if the Negro had a few more faults too, like all of us have. And I do think that the Negroes themselves are hurting themselves, and we're helping them hurt themselves in the public image by allowing them to dominate the fact that you cannot use an absolute truthful thing about a Negro of the, say, 50 years ago. I might be crucified for saying this, but I believe it sincerely.
Just one further thought occurs to me, that obviously what we're going to need are more Negro producers and directors before a lot of what we're talking about will change. That up till now, most films you've seen about Negroes are made by white people, and this obviously will bring to it all their inner and outer prejudices both ways. And again, perhaps it will be first in the independent movement that we will get some of this. But even there, it's curious to note that in the 300 filmmakers and the filmmakers co-op, only two are black. And that's a pretty small record in the area of filmmaking.
Because they could get in if they wanted.
Oh yes, there's no problem. It's just they don't exist. Yeah.
Who doesn't exist?
Negro film directors and film producers.
Just pay attention.
Lost grip on 24 million people suddenly when I heard they didn't exist. The next was a question here which I put off. But there are several. Why don't several of you come and sort of make yourselves comfortable down here and just ask your questions in order? There was a question over here.
Yeah.
Ask me all at once.
My name is Robert Beyer. You've been using the word adult rather loosely, or rather quite explicitly, in fact. I'd like to know if any of you recognize any distinction between what might be called an adult film and what is an artistically serious film, and that whether, while according to, change in censorship is certainly easier to make an adult film, and certainly more than are being made, whether on the whole films being made today are any more serious than they were 20, 30 years ago, and if perhaps on the whole they're less serious, which I might suggest they are.
My question was
practically similar, so perhaps I just add one point onto it. It was also a definition of mature, a definition of grown-up. Could you each give one definition of what you consider when you keep saying the movies are growing up, or the audience is more mature, or the movie is more mature in line with that? Because the one thing I would have asked from our American movies, as a person who likes Europe and been involved with Europeans, is that I found all my nourishment, once I've been educated to a certain point, from the European movies. And I hadn't met too much of the underground, quote, movies before. But otherwise, I would ask, why can't the Hollywood movies become, you know, give a few artistic, really good movies on
the
equal?
Let's stop this for a second, because it isn't now quite the same question any longer. You can take any part of that question you want to. People are sticking you with the title published for this evening about movies growing up. So you can finesse this question if you want. But I think the first question, as I understood it, was do you mean the same by adult as somebody might mean by a serious movie? And if not, don't you think perhaps movies used to be at least, if not more serious, than they are now?
Is there, I think Ms. Christ said it earlier, are we terribly sure, and wasn't that heading of this title of our talk, didn't it have a question mark at the end of it? Couldn't it also be read, movies coming of age? Couldn't that be a way of saying it too? I'm not so terribly sure that just because censorship is here, that we're getting really more adult with our movies. I think it's given us a chance to breathe a little bit and maybe try something like the personal movies, which Miss Clark has done so extremely well. I saw one of them, which is one of the most interesting films I've ever seen in my life, which was at the Expo, which is Man and the Polar Regions. But that to me was a fascinating film. I can't go into the subject of whether it was adult or non-adult. It was just a marvelous, interesting film. I think there are very interesting films being made now, but there were interesting films being made when censorship was at its height, too. I don't think that there's a tremendous trend toward movies growing up. I think we are just stepping falteringly, trying to make them get better. And I think, as Ms. Christ pointed out early, it's a question of our growing up. I think our country's got to grow up before the movies grow up. I think we're very immature. I think we don't know what we feel, and we don't have that sense of adultness that would create an adult movie. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. It's very probably sounds a little bit stupid, but I guess maybe I am.
I want to say one thing which interests me a good deal. At this present moment in New York City, four films are playing that are known as non-story films. And this is a new direction, not so much in filmmaking, but as Ms. Chris pointed out, in the fact that audiences are now willing to go and see these films in art houses. What this has done is open the doors to expanding filmmaking per se, so that more filmmakers will explore those areas of filmmaking. I'm not sure that this has to do with growing up or, you know, I must say I agree with Mr. Logan, this country is awfully immature and we reflect it very, very well. But certainly film is changing, and I think it's changing in a rather interesting way. In many ways it's changing back to where it began with Lumiere and the very earliest films that were ever made.
Yeah, basically this business of adult seems to me to have started out with the Western, wasn't it? I mean, High Noon, they said, was an adult Western because it was not a cliché Western. But it seems to me that the latest bit of semantics over this began with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you know, just so that it could be, could get a seal and be distributed. Persons under 18 could not see it unless accompanied by their parents. And I think there was many a parent who needed someone of 17 along, you know, to tell them what was happening. So this is just a part of the gimmickry. Also, I would not equate serious with intellectual maturity gauge of a movie. Again, these are semantics, but I think one of the most grown-up movies that we have made in recent years was Dr. Strangelove. And yet serious somehow is only at the core in a purely Swiftian sense. But some of the best American films have been satiric comedies that had a grown-up approach or thesis or concept. I couldn't agree more than with Miss Clark that there's nothing, there's more of a reversion than a change. It's just that some of us are younger than some older people, that we are unaware of the regressiveness in movie techniques to the very original freedom that came with the discovery. It startles people to know that everything that they had in Expo in the way of film techniques, they had at the 1900 Paris Exposition. It's just that they were not adapted commercially until economics in this country provoked them, that's all. But it is, movies reflect, they don't set styles except in hairdos and home furnishings. You know, they're way behind what is happening at the moment.
Except perhaps the non-story films, which are coming along, and Miss Clark is a representative of the personal films. I think the most adult films that I've seen perhaps are, let's say, Lillian Hellman's Little Foxes several years ago, quite a long number of years ago, nearly over 20, and Wuthering Heights, it seems to me, as I look back, was a pretty adult film. I think The Best Years of Our Lives was an adult film. Now, those were in the days of terrible censorship, and nothing could be shown at all. As I recall, the married people were in the twin beds, you know. That was in that period. I do think that you're right when you ask us to define adult and define mature. I think a mature film is a film that makes its point. That I think a film is when a director does what the author meant him to do. I think that's a mature film, and I think there have been lots of those. Some of them go a little out of style because the styles change a bit. But I'm sure in its day, Gone with the Wind was a very mature film. It may still be. I haven't seen it, but I'm pretty sure it is.
It still is.
It still is. Sure it is. I'm sure it is. Even though the worst thing he says is, I don't give a damn. You know, but and so everybody says, oh my goodness, imagine. Back in those days, they said, I don't give a damn.
Yeah, and then you get Two for the Road that has as its finale today, you bastard bitch, and that's high comedy.
The only thing that I would ever dare disagree with Miss Crist on is that Dr. Strangelove was a mature film. I think it was the most adolescent film I ever saw in my life.
See, that's what makes box office.
It seemed to me there were just young kids trying to show, I mean, grown men trying to act like little boys. And I couldn't laugh. All right, hiss. I hate you too.
Next thing he'll tell you is that Bonnie and Clyde isn't a great movie.
What? Bonnie and Clyde is the greatest movie I've seen in 10 years. I have never seen a better movie. It sure is. And don't listen to Bonzi Crowther when he talks about it. Read the people who write the letters in about it, that the Times gives as much space as they've ever given to anything in the world. Very interesting that the New York Times didn't fire him. They just printed so many letters that finally it made him stop writing about against them.
My name is...
The most mature thing that ever happened, excuse me, was when a critic in the Newsweek wrote a terrible notice, a fellow named Morgenstern, of Bonnie and Clyde, and then went back and saw the picture again with an audience and saw it in an entirely new light and had the nerve to sit down and say, I was wrong. It's the bravest thing I've seen done by an American in a long time. I'm finished. I promise you.
Go on. You finally disagreed about something. As long as you watch your language, we're on radio, don't forget.
I missed it.
Right now, he says we're on radio. Right now?
No, later, after those words are taken out.
You mean to say that bastard and bitch can't be on radio? It seems to me those are the two most innocent words I've heard all evening. I don't know.
I'm shocked.
You're shocked and I'm afraid to start. My name is Guy Moss. It seems that one view of the movie that we've been taking is the movie as an art form, but yet equally important would be the view, at least held by some, that the movie should be a moneymaker. So I should like to ask Mr. Logan and Miss Clark, I suppose they fancy themselves artists as opposed to moneymakers, or at least predominantly artists, to what extent their art is limited or constrained by the necessity to make money. And involved in that would be the idea of appealing to what they fancy their audience wants, appealing to the mass taste. And to Mrs. Christ, I should like to ask, to what extent is your criticism based on the picture being limited in this respect, or do you criticize, or would you like to criticize, only to place the film on the highest level of art that you'd like to see it?
That's an interesting question. Speaking for myself, I have placed myself in the position of making films outside of the studios in order to be allowed a certain amount of freedom of choice as to what I do. I have discovered as the years have gone on that it becomes more and more difficult to make each film, because unfortunately if you are not commercially successful with large audiences, and movie audiences no matter what, whether they're small masses or large masses, are nevertheless masses, you find that you can't continue making films, so that you do have to consider the audience. What interests me is that the audience has been changing. Primarily, it seems to me, it's been changing in the university world. And I look to that particular area for, let's say, where films like the kind I make will play and will get a sufficient response so that economically it will be feasible to go on making this kind of movie. But right off the bat, one limits oneself in terms of subject and techniques and styles because of the amount of money you can spend. Filmmaking is extremely expensive. One can't imagine in their wildest dreams how much something can cost. Something very, very simple, let's say, such as making a shot of all of us sitting here tonight, which would be properly lit and properly photographed, could cost thousands of dollars. And therefore, people who work independently by that very nature, must select subjects that will allow them to work that way. And that is pretty much the way they sort of solve the problem for themselves.
I envy Miss Clark. I would give anything I can think of to be able to work as close to saying what she personally feels like saying as she has been able to do so far. I'm sure it's terribly difficult. I'm sure that it costs far more money than anyone would ever dream, such a small, supposedly unpretentious picture, as far as lighting, casting, or anything else goes, could be. The thing that I unfortunately have gotten into is the fact that I have to earn my living in a profession. And therefore, I have to pay grocery bills and tuition fees for my children. And so therefore, I can't just go out. I haven't got a sponsor. I haven't got a Medici family to give me the money to go out and do just what I want to do. But then I think another thing. I'm not terribly sure that it's always good, and I'm certainly not referring to Miss Clark's film. I'm talking about the so-called closet drama, the drama where an artist is supposed to work only for himself, only to please himself. He sits in his wonderful study or ivory tower or on his beach and pleases himself and says, to hell with the rest of the world. I will throw my verses or my play in a bottle and let them float out to sea. I don't care whether anyone likes them. I don't believe in that. I don't believe that's necessarily art. I don't think it's more artistic. I think that art is also partly communication. I think it matters that people come and see a painting, such as the Sistine Chapel. I think that the people who see it make it as much art as the fact that it's there on the fresco. I also think that's true of plays and movies. And if you say to me, as I have heard some people say, that the really great artists don't care whether their plays or movies are successful or not, I say that's not art. That's masturbation. I think art is intercourse.
I agree.
Thank you.
I agree. I also think, however, from a purely critical viewpoint, that we have to make one thing clear, and this does not mean that every piece of film is a piece of art. It makes me nervous as discussions more and more today get on to the art of film and the film as art. I think that there are a lot of movies, particularly in this country, movies are an industrial product, and they are made for a market. And occasionally, and perhaps more and more often now, we are getting the hand-tooled product, the one of special design, the one individually made. But for the most part, movies are ground out for a certain purpose. Now, I think it is the part of the critic, of all of us, to understand to what purpose a film has been made. And I, for one, am extremely bored at the way in which Time magazine feels it has to flagellate every Walt Disney movie. Walt Disney was not making movies under the illusion that he was Alan Rene. He was making movies for a very specific purpose, and for that purpose, the movies were fine. And I think this is the level. And they weren't always fine. Sometimes they were even nauseating for the purpose. But when they worked, they worked. And there are many cups to be filled with different brews of tea. Just as with novels, just as with music, and so on. And I think we have to take each one for what it was intended to be. And this is the basic critical role.
Well, we're all in agreement again. Another question.
My name is Joel Haycott. There are certain critics that are extremely fond of lamenting the supposed irresponsibility of the medium. Do you feel that films have a responsibility? And if so, is it to certain artistic qualities, or is it to social comment, Terry? Or is it just, as perhaps Bosley Crawford would suggest, to eliminate antisocial elements?
Well, of course, I think that everyone should have the highest ideals and the highest sense of social responsibility. But again, you're in an industrial area here, and so long as there is going to be an audience for what some critics or other critics are perpetually calling irresponsible portrayal of facts, you know, where everybody will wind up dead in close-up, in color preferably, or I, a woman, you know, great. You can say, well, what social irresponsibility there is in making that kind of movie? Well, in making it and distributing it, you make $1 million. And unfortunately, in our state of human development, this is not considered social irresponsibility. In color, preferably, or I, a woman, you know, great. You can say, well, what social irresponsibility there is in making that kind of movie? Well, in making it and distributing it, you make $1 million. And unfortunately, in our state of human development, this is not considered social irresponsibility. You know what I mean? I'm begging the question entirely, because I think, you know, the answer, of course, is obvious, that all who are not dedicated to the finest ideals are socially irresponsible, but you could spend your whole life lamenting that and really not get anywhere.
Especially interesting to me is the reference to Bosley Crowther, who the other day wrote in a Sunday piece that now that the censorship as rules have been broken and that the code is lenient, we must, as critics and public, become censors. And I was shocked to see that he felt that someone had to move in there and become his own censor. It is a responsibility now of the critics to become censors. I thought that was rather strange. Did you read that piece?
Yeah.
And I think to have him, you know, we spent all these years getting rid of them, and now we got one, you know, that's developing right there and asking people to applaud him. I think that worries me a bit. Did you read that?
No, I didn't, but I appreciate his point. It's ugly work, but somebody's got to do it.
Why? Why does somebody have to do it?
It's like
why
torture.
Can't the public? It seems to me that the public will censor their own thing. They will just stay away from terrible things. They will. They don't go rushing to pornography. I'll bet you, Miss Clark. I'll bet you, Miss Clark, will bear me out. I think they stay away from it. It disgusts them. They, you know, in the first place, isn't nakedness a bit boring eventually? You know, we've all seen naked people. We've even seen ourselves, God forbid, naked, you know? I remember when I was a kid in Louisiana, some people took their Negro mammy to Europe with them, you know, to take care of the kids, you know. And she was a dear old thing, and she'd been taking care of them for years, and they were going through the Louvre, and, you know, there were the statues of Hermes and Apollo without fig leaves, and the kids kept watching her to see what she was going to say because she was very, very serious about things. And finally they said, Aunt Amy, what do you think of these things? And she said, honey, I dressed and undressed your boy cousins and your big brothers, and such things as this ain't no recreation for me. And I don't think it is any recreation. I think after a while it's a bore. If it makes a point, nudity is worthwhile. But just nudity to excite, well, it won't excite very long, and people will stay away from it.
I think we better have one final question.
My name is Nick Rabkin. Assuming, as I think you have, that the movie Come of Age is the movie that is artistically sophisticated, and assuming, as I think we have, that American movies, for the most part, have not been artistically sophisticated, that I might suggest that a lot of European movies have picked up American suggestions and made them artistically sophisticated. I've pretty much stayed away from American movies for the past few years, but I was very happy to see a movie of the order of Bonnie and Clyde when I saw it. I was wondering if Miss Clark or Mr. Logan, I suppose Mrs. Christ would also have some insight into this, what the possibilities of Hollywood turning out artistically sophisticated films are. Obviously, it can be done.
I would imagine that Arthur Penn can now, who to me, I happen to like the movie he made before Bonnie and Clyde, which was called Mickey One. I think I was about the only person who liked it, or so it read in the prints at any rate. But now, because Bonnie and Clyde has been a commercial success, Arthur Penn is going to be able to write his very own ticket.
Until the next one.
Right. And if it is a commercial success, then he will be able to make still another.
There's an old expression in Hollywood saying you're just as good as your last picture. And it's a terrible thing, but that's true. It's not so much that I want Camelot to be a success as I want another job afterwards. That's really what it is. And one of the things is that we do have a kind of Hollywood attitude. There's no question about it. I think one of the reasons that she is a lucky girl is that she's not out there yet. But maybe they'll get her, and then she...
We have the same problem.
I'm sure.
It's not any different.
I'm sure it is.
Actually, at this moment, Portrait of Jason is not doing particularly well in New York. And this is very worrisome to me, because unless it does, I won't make another movie. It's really... an absolute fact. That
yes, you will, because we'll all make you. We'll just make you make another.
No, but this has been true. I remember once meeting Fellini, and he was bemoaning the fact that Rossellini had not made a film for a number of years because Stromboli was not a success. And this is not true only of American filmmakers. This is true of foreign filmmakers. This is just true in general of filmmaking, because it is a commercial industry as well as possibly an art form. But certainly it must be successful. Now that throws it right back at you by saying, meaning the audience appreciated Bonnie and Clyde, and therefore it was a success. It was also possible that it might not have. And then what would have happened? It would not have changed the fact that it was a good movie.
My question still is a bit broader than that, I think. Now that Arthur Penn has done it for himself, I recognize the fact that he'll be able to get the money for another film for himself.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, you know, will somebody else be able to go to Hollywood and make a movie of the same
type? I'll bet you that there are five Bonnie and Clydes being planned right this minute. You know, I think that somebody's saying, now look, we'll change their names and we'll have them go through Omaha instead of Idaho. That's Hollywood for you. If it's a big hit, they want to do seven of them. But I don't think, you see, I don't think it really opens up. To answer your question, I think we still have a pretty immature place called Hollywood, which is part of an immature place called America. Well, and I think as long as we worry about the dollar all the time, we're going to be in trouble.
Mrs. Chris mentioned the fact, or Miss Clark mentioned the fact that there were four non-story films in New York now. Portrait of Jason and City Cut Follies are among them, I guess.
The Dylan film, for the moment I can't think of the other. But I remember noticing the other day that Battle of Algiers.
Will these films make any impact on commercial distribution?
Yes, I'm sure that they will.
Independent films.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure they will. Well, all we can do, I think, when you come right down to it, is cross our fingers and pray. Because that's all. That's about all we can do. We just keep on working and do the best we can. And and if you all will support the films that you think that you really like, then maybe we can all keep working and maybe we'll finally get better films.
I'm surprised that nobody here asked the question, which I would have thought with this particular audience would have been asked, which is, can films change anything in the world? In other words, can you make a film that will therefore change, you know...
Well, you mean the way that Uncle Tom's Cabin changed the attitude of the Civil
right,
War?
Right, right,
yes.
Right.
Well, I think...
And
perhaps.
I think in particular of a film that was made in France called Nous Nous Sommes Les... We Are All Murderers, which was made by a French lawyer against capital punishment, and from what I've been told, within 2 years after the film was released, the laws against capital punishment were changed in France. And I would imagine that this was something that might be of interest.
Maybe some film could be made that would eventually prevent the sale of guns all over the United States.
Yeah.
That can be ordered from almost any... whatever you call those places where you ride in. I can't think of the word.
Since we're talking about a mass media, and obviously, you know, what effect does it have on the masses that, let's say, is positive as well as negative?
Well, the panelists are now asking themselves questions. At time we have to quit. We've all enjoyed this very much. Thank you, Mr. Logan, Mrs. Christ, Ms. Clark. Enjoyable evening.